Welcome to Patricia Sheridan's Breakfast With, the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette's weekly Q&A with the people behind the headlines. Today I talk with award-winning documentary filmmaker Ken Burns. He changed the way audiences responded to the stodgy genre with his unique style of moving the camera around still photos, employing music, and the written word. This way of filming has become known as the Ken Burns effect. The 58-year-old became well-known after his PBS special, The Civil War, in 1990. It gained critical and popular acclaim. His 15-hour documentary, The War, which he made in 2007, was the longest movie ever shown at the Cannes Film Festival. It has recently been released on Blu-ray by Paramount. He talks about growing up post-World War II and playing combat in his backyard, the brutality of the war, and how we've romanticized and idealized it, his own father's experience, and living in the past when he's deep into a project, and so much more.
So, since you did grow up in the 50s, I'm wondering, did you play combat with your friends?
Oh, absolutely. My father, who had arrived in Europe in 45, you know, as part of the liberating armies, you know, I was filled with the stories of the Second World War, always sanitized and devoid of any of the horrors. But my brother and I dug trenches in our backyard and killed Germans with both imaginary and play machine guns and rifles, and it was very much a part of my growing up. And this is, in some ways, part of the extension of myself growing up and understanding as the Civil War I did for another important war, what really happened. And I think we've tended to romanticize the Second World War. We call it the good war. It's actually the worst war ever. We talk about it as the greatest generation, but then we don't say, what did that greatest generation do? And fortunately, there have been good books, and there's movies like Saving Private Ryan, in which Steven Spielberg is willing to dive beyond. There's TV series that Tom Hanks and Steven Spielberg did, you know, of the Band of Brothers.
That's right.
That permit us to sort of open up. And our series was an attempt to do the same thing, to look at the greatest cataclysm in human history, the Second World War, not from the perspective of presidents and generals, but from so-called ordinary people in four geographically distributed American towns.
And, you know, just as you pointed out, so much has been written about World War II and filmed and movies. Did you uncover anything that surprised you?
Every day. Someone pointed out about three-quarters of the way through that this was the first time we'd made a film in which there already were 1,000 films on the subject. Like, usually we're like the first or the second to do something about it. And fortunately, with the case of the Civil War, you know, the most noteworthy. But nobody done jazz, nobody done baseball, nobody done the national parks in quite the same way that we'd done it. But here there were 1,000 films. But we did it differently. And this is a World War II film that was shown at the Cannes Film Festival 15 hours long. It's the longest film that's ever been shown there. And it's got an American point of view, and it was celebrated. It was really very, very exciting. And I think now, with the release of the Blu-ray by Paramount and PBS, it's really going to be in your living room. And that was our idea, to bring the experience of the war home. And I think too often we get distracted by the bells and whistles of in color or HD and forget that the story is still most important. So the care and the craft with which this new edition has been made is hugely, hugely important. And I think it's many people have said, of those 1,000, this is the best documentary on the Second World War. I'm the worst judge of that.
Wow.
I made it. I like it. But I want everybody to have an opportunity to see it and understand what that greatest generation went through.
And, you know, because there was so much material, is that ever a challenge, that there's too much material?
Sure, of course. You know, in some films, when you work in the 19th century or late 18th century, it's the absence of material, which is the tyranny,
mm-hmm.
and you forge new things. Sometimes it's too much material, but what we had and what PBS permitted us was the luxury of time. We spent years. So where the stuff that you see on the History Channel is, you know, they're taking off the main table of World War II highlights, we could ask for the negative and look at all the outtakes and find out that it was originally shot in color, or that amazingly famous footage of the guy dropping at Omaha Beach, there's actually not 3 seconds of that, but 7 seconds, and two other Americans drop. And that makes it exponentially more painful and more meaningful to us. Those are the types of things that we're able to do. So, yes, it's always a huge management job that, you know, we always say since we're living, work in New Hampshire, that it's like maybe making maple syrup. You know, it takes 40 gallons of sap to make 1 gallon of maple syrup. We have 40 times the amount of material to go into our finished film. So just multiply 15 hours times 40, you know what we're talking about. We have 600 hours of stuff. But that boiling down is what we do. That's what you pay us, in quotes, to do. You ask us to distill that. You ask us to boil that sap down into a syrup that's, you know, palatable.
You know, the Civil War really put you into the spotlight in what you do. And now this series, War, what do you think it is in general that viewers gravitate to when it comes to war?
Here's the thing. It's one of the great human paradoxes that when your life is most threatened, when violent death is possible at any moment, something you and I are not experiencing at this moment, life is vivified to a height not felt anywhere, not in love, not in sex, not in anything. And that vivification produces obviously the worst of human behavior, or manifests the worst of human behavior, but it also manifests the best. And so war becomes a kind of concentrated version, a kind of supercharged version of human experience. So we're drawn to war because we can't believe that human beings do this, and yet we know that we do this.
Yeah.
And this is the worst one of them all. You know, it's so funny that we call it the good war.
Yeah.
How can you call the death of 60 million human beings a good war? We know why it is. It's because we felt we had the cause was right in all subsequent wars, Korea and Vietnam and the Gulf Wars and Afghanistan. You know, we weren't quite sure of the objectives. Here we knew what it was. But this was more ghastly than all those other wars that I've mentioned put together times 10. And yet we call it the good war.
And, you know, because it's so, you work on such a visual scale, do you find that when you're deep into a project like war that it's always on your thoughts, that you're actually living in that time?
Oh, yeah. We were deep in the editing where all our films are made. And I would have these dreams that I was at Peleliu, which was a particularly horrible, horrible battle, an island that didn't need to be fought in the Pacific. And we do a big scene of that in our episode called FUBAR, our fifth episode, which I think you know what the acronym FUBAR stands for. And we have to explain that in the opening of the film. But I remember dreaming for many nights in a row that I was filming for Peleliu, and then always within the dream it changed to being in Peleliu, that I was no longer a filmmaker trying to solve the problems in the editing room. I'm now in it, and I have a camera, and then suddenly, what do I do? How do I protect myself? And I'd go in and I'd look at my editor, and he'd look like he'd just been through the ringer, and I'd say, where were you? And he'd say, Okinawa, or Battle of the Bulge, or Hurtgen Forest, all these horrible, horrible places that. And so, yeah, I mean, it was a necessary thing that we had to go through. And what we went through is not even one millionth of what any kid who is 19 years old who suddenly found himself in some place not to conquer, not to gain economic gain or glory or whatever, but to save the world from tyranny. I mean, it's an it's still about the best story I know.
You know, so much goes into producing a documentary like this. When it's finished, are you ready to let it go?
It's hard. Yes, you know, you have to do that. People say that works of art aren't finished, they're abandoned. Mm-hmm. And there is a bit of truth to that. I mean, you work at it and you say, this is what I can do to the best of my abilities right now. And you let it go.
Yeah.
And then it's not so much that you feel remorse at letting it go, because it goes out in the world like your own children. I don't know about you. I've got two daughters that are grown, two
Me
daughters
too.
Still at home. But they're out in the world, and I have a different relationship to them. They're on their own. But you're still nonetheless proud of them. And, you know, one's made me a grandfather, so that's really great, you know.
Congratulations.
This is, you know, it's just it takes on a different phase. And this film, you know, I was telling someone else earlier, and a nearly 90-year-old veteran came up to me in the airport and said, and looked like he had seen a ghost. He walked across and he said, Ken Burns, and his voice was breaking. I nodded, and he couldn't say anything, and he just put his arms around me and he started to cry.
That gives me chills.
And then I like hugged him back and I started to cry, and then we just looked at each other. In the middle of the airport, people must have thought he was my grandfather. And we just split up. There was nothing to be said.
Wow.
And then you realize, you know, that's the reward of this work. And now when you have the chance to see it the way it is now with what Paramount and PBS have done with the Blu-ray, oh my goodness, it just, you know, if you've got a good sound system, if you've got a good TV set, I mean,
it'll
what we want to do is put you there. And I wouldn't wish that on anyone, but at the same time, we all have to know what our fathers and grandfathers went through.
Yeah. Did your father see combat, or did he?
No. He was so fortunate. He arrived in Europe in April of 45, so he missed it. But I still think even the devastation and the destruction was too much for him.
So he never talked to you about it?
No. The stories he told were the broadest painted stuff. So we fought the idealized good war in the backyard. But doing this, it opened it up to what it was really like.
Which was really, truly hell.
I mean, hell on earth.
And you said it. When you think of the age of, they were boys.
Well, I was interviewed a guy who kept saying, and then these kids would come up. And I'd say, Paul, what are you talking about? This is Paul Fussell, the great writer on the Second World War, and a combat infantryman on the line, meaning he was a good killer. I said, Paul, what are you talking about? How old are these kids? He said, 18. I said, how old are you? He goes, 19. That 1 year difference was the difference between, like, say, 20 years old and 60 years old. And, I mean, it was terrifying to do the interview myself with him. I had a pit in the stomach. My heart was pounding. I didn't know what I was going to do. I couldn't breathe. And can you imagine? And I'm safely in the aughts, doing an interview in the comfort of a room, and he's becoming 19 years old before my very eyes. The first two roles, he's being professorial, and it's like, ho-hum. And all of a sudden, I looked at him, and I said, you saw bad things. And his cheeks started to twitch, and his lips started to crack, and he just went back in time, and he was a 19-year-old killer.
Wow.
And it's always about nearly being killed, watching your friends die, and killing other people. It's the worst thing you could possibly do.
Do you see, when you do stuff like this, do you start to find parallels in the present to what you're looking at in the past?
Of course, but the Bible's told us this for 5,000 years. It's Ecclesiastes. What has been will be again. What has been done will be done again. There's nothing new under the sun. That's Ecclesiastes 1:9. Human nature remains the same. And so whether it's our film on Prohibition, which if I gave you the themes of it, would be the themes of today, or the Second World War, of course you can find resonances. But my job is not to be a political filmmaker. That only talks to one side of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's to speak to all Americans. I don't care what your political orientation is. I want to share with you a story. And what's really positive in all of this is that history is still a table around which we can all, red state or blue state, young or old, rich or poor, black or white, gay or straight, north or west, east or west, north or south, we can subscribe to these things. And that's the stories I'm trying to tell. I'm trying to reach everybody.
Thanks for listening. For more conversations, check the pages of Monday's Pittsburgh Post-Gazette or visit postgazette.com, the area's most visited website. While there, you'll be able to access the Post-Gazette's slate of other weekly podcasts on TV, the movies, food, technology, and other topics. If you have comments or suggestions, send email to hereandnow@post-gazette.com. I'm Patricia Sheridan.